Good. Okay, so this course is quantum field theory for cosmology. And it's a bit of an unusual kind of course on quantum field theory. Normally, quantum field theory is taught for particle physics. It's all about symmetry breaking, renormalization, fermions, the gauge principle, the standard model, perhaps supersymmetry. That's usually what quantum field theory is about. And the goal there is to describe the interactions of particles, how when you smash particles into each other, new particles are being created, and how that explains everything that we can measure in accelerators, and therefore everything that the world is made of. This course is doing quantum field theory from a different perspective. It's still the same theory, but the focus is a different one. Instead of studying the symmetries among particles and what kinds of species of particles there are, instead, this course focuses on the effect that quantum theory has on the vacuum, and on how the vacuum and the quantum effects of the vacuum are modified when space-time is dynamical, when it is expanding, or when there are black holes. It turns out that quantum field theory shows unexpected, strange features when there is curvature or when there's acceleration. So this course on quantum field theory will start from scratch, introduce quantum field theory from the very beginning, and therefore has pretty much the same beginning as any other quantum field theory course. But then it will soon go in this other direction. It used to be that this was a very... Sorry, still recovering from a bad cold. It used to be that this branch of quantum field theory, no thanks, got to talk. It used to be that this branch of quantum field theory was something very specialized that only very few people would work on. Because the big experiments were all about accelerators and smashing particles into each other. But then it turned out that this branch of quantum field theory also makes predictions for experiments. And those predictions have been confirmed experimentally, dramatically, and therefore this is now no longer so unusual that we actually teach courses on quantum field theory on curved space-time. The key prediction that is actually measurable of quantum field theory on curved space-time is that when space-time expands very rapidly, then quantum fluctuations, which, as you know, are ubiquitous, that happen everywhere all the time, those quantum fluctuations can be expanded to large scales. Remember, quantum fluctuations happen everywhere, all the time, but they tend to be tiny. Tiny in amplitude, tiny in wavelength. But if space-time, or whenever space-time is expanding dramatically, very, very quickly, then there is a chance that these quantum fluctuations, before they can, so to speak, recollapse, they get grabbed by the expansion and are being made very, very large. That was first predicted in the 1980s, early 80s. And it was thought that maybe this explains the origin of structure in the universe. Big question is, why is the universe not completely homogeneous? The galaxies are distributed in a particular random pattern. There is some system to that. You can check what the average distance is between galaxies, and you can measure what's the probability that if there's a galaxy here, that another one is only this far away or that far away, and so on. You can work out what the statistics is of the distribution of matter in the universe. And then you can ask, well, why is it this distribution, not another one? This is the problem of structure formation. And in the early 80s, the idea was developed that maybe those initial inhomogeneities in the universe about which the galaxies then condensed were really quantum fluctuations whose origin is, as usual, at very, very small scales, quantum fluctuations, which, however, close to the Big Bang, shortly after the Big Bang, were stretched out to huge scales. If that theory is right, then the reason why galaxies are where they are is that very shortly after the Big Bang, quantum fluctuations, which happened, as usual, only at very small scales with small amplitude, were stretched out by the expansion of the universe to cosmological size. And those quantum fluctuations were translated into quantum fluctuations of energy density, therefore of gravity, and therefore they were able to act as the seeds about which galaxies could condense. At the time, in the early 80s, that was one theory out of many. For example, Neil Turok, here the director of Perimeter, was following the idea that the inhomogeneities in the universe arose from defects in phase transition. If, for example, you take water, then it's a very homogeneous liquid. When you cool it down, it will turn into a crystal. If you cool down water very, very, very slowly, from just above freezing to below freezing, then you get a crystal forming that's pretty nice, pretty regular. If, however, you flash freeze water, then you get that crystals form at different places at once, very quickly, and they have no chance that they would be all aligned, because they just, you know, they start growing all over the place in random directions. And then when those crystals grow, they start touching each other, but they will have a mismatch of their alignment. So you get defects. So therefore, the ice crystal is not going to be homogeneous at all. You can try this out. If you freeze water very quickly, you get very milky ice. If you freeze it very, very slowly, you get very transparent ice. That's how that works. Sorry. Now, the universe underwent some phase transitions. And so the idea was that maybe some phase transitions were undergone very quickly, and therefore inhomogeneities were introduced, and maybe the galaxies condensed about those inhomogeneities. Now, there were other theories as well. And the theory that holds that quantum fluctuations were expanded to cosmological size, where they then seeded the condensation of galaxies, made specific predictions about the distribution of energy in the universe, and then the defect theory from phase transitions made other predictions, other theories made other predictions, and spectacularly, the one with the quantum fluctuations won, many years after it was predicted. So one of the main aims of this course is going to be to be able to calculate those quantum fluctuations, how they get stretched out to cosmological size, what kinds of quantum fluctuations they are, and how they created the structure in the universe. Ultimately, the reason why you are sitting where you are, why, you know, stuff is distributed the way it is, according to that theory, which seems pretty much confirmed, is ultimately traceable to quantum fluctuations. It's a pretty wild theory, but experiment says that there's something to it. Okay, so that's, we will also do, of course, Hawking radiation and things like that, but that hasn't been measured. So the biggest success of quantum field theory on curved spacetime has been the prediction, the correct prediction of the formation of structure in the universe. That will be the main goal of this course, to be able to calculate that. And that theory is called cosmic inflation. Inflation for the inflating of the universe, the almost exponential inflating of the universe shortly after the Big Bang. So it's a pretty dramatic thing that we will get to towards the end of the course. Let's start from scratch. So here's a bit of historical background. more than 100 years ago, around the year 1900, it turned out that classical mechanics became untenable. Experimentally, it became clear classical mechanics is not right. There were several reasons for that. One was black body radiation. It turned out that classical theory predicted that the heat radiation given off by objects, should have a spectrum that is actually divergent. If you take an object like this, it doesn't have to be black, it's just easier to calculate the heat radiation of a black object than of a colored one. If you take a black object at a certain temperature, then the shaking of the charges in it will create electromagnetic fields, and that's the heat radiation. And classical theory would have it that the higher the frequency is that you look at, the stronger should be the radiation. Obviously, that can't be right. It would mean that any object like this would flash radiate off all of its energy immediately. Because the higher the frequency you look at, the more is the output power. Can't be right. But classical theory was predicting that. That's the so-called ultraviolet catastrophe, ultraviolet for short wavelength, high frequency. Max Planck, when he was a grad student, was given the task of fixing this. So his supervisor, Scholli, said, well, Planck, I don't think physics is a good area to go into because we know it all now. It's just a matter of adding a few digits of precision to our experimental data. But if you insist, there's one little thing, which is that nobody figured out how to calculate the heat radiation of objects. It's obviously wrong what we normally calculate. So go and figure out what's wrong and fix this and calculate, you know, the spectrum of radiation given off by a warm body. And of course, Planck found that the spectrum comes out right if you assume that electromagnetic radiation is given off in quanta. Now, there was also the photoelectric effect. Again, a mystery. It turned out that when you shine light onto certain substances, certain metals, if you shine light on certain substances, then electrons will be kicked out of them, charges will come out of them. So the light is kicking charges out of the material, but strangely, the effect didn't seem to depend on the intensity of the light. It seemed to depend on the color of the light. If you used red light, it just wouldn't work at all, no matter how much intensity you put into it. But if you used blue light, you would get plenty of ionization, even with low intensity. So how was that possible? If light was really waves. And of course, Einstein came along and explained that this has to do with photons doing the kicking. And as Planck had indicated, well, those photons have discrete energies. And then there was this little thing of the stability of matter. It had become clear that there are atoms. it was clear that there were positive charges in the center and negative charges that were sort of orbiting those positive charges. But then according to electromagnetism, it was clear that that was not a stable arrangement. If you had a heavy nucleus, positively charged, and then some negative charges chasing around that, well, then those negative charges create, while they travel, they create varying, time-varying electromagnetic fields. A charge is traveling, so it's creating time-varying electromagnetic fields. But a time-varying electromagnetic field is creating time-varying electromagnetic fields. Right? You know that from the Maxwell equations. When an electric field decays, it produces a magnetic field. When a magnetic field decays, it produces an electric field. And that process leads to the traveling waves of electromagnetism. So when an electron is orbiting a proton, then that electron should radiate off energy continually, and should therefore fall into or orbit ever closer to the proton and should eventually fall into it. So therefore, atoms shouldn't be stable. Now, this was resolved through the uncertainty principle. It turned out that the uncertainty principle holds when an electron is confined to an area that's, or a volume that's small enough, delta x is very small, then delta p has to be large. But if delta p is large, it means the electron can escape. It must have enough energy not to fall into the proton. So the uncertainty principle is stabilizing matter. By 1925, they had figured out the theory behind all of this. It was Heisenberg who first came up with quantum mechanics. And he understood that the equations of motion of quantum mechanics stay the same. So for example, for a harmonic oscillator, classically, that's the equation of motion. Quantum mechanically, it is too. However, Heisenberg figured out that the usual equation of motion has to be supplemented with an equation that requires non-commutativity between positions and momenta. He figured out that canonical commutation relations must hold. And then half a year later, Schrödinger discovered the Schrödinger equation. For a little while, there was competition between the two theories. They looked very different. But then Dirac, in the same year, figured out that actually the two theories are the same. It's just a different choice of bases in the Hilbert space. One is a basis that has the vectors rotate in Hilbert space, and the other one is the Heisenberg picture where the operators are rotating in Hilbert space. That was Dirac who figured that out. So all of that happened in 1925, 1926. This was quite a revolution in physics. It required fundamental changes in the way things were calculated. In particular, notice this. Heisenberg found that the position and the momentum operators have to be non-commutative, which of course immediately meant that the positions as a function of time and the momenta as a function of time cannot be number valued. Because if they just take values in the numbers, then clearly they have to be commuting. But they have to be non-commutative. So then they were wondering, well, okay, what kind of things are non-commutative? Well, for example, matrices are non-commutative. And this is how Heisenberg started out. He said, okay, maybe x hat of t, p hat of t, ought to be really matrix-valued functions of time. But then realized that, while it is possible, it is not possible to have these matrices finite dimensional. This is quite important. Remember that the spin commutation relations from quantum mechanics, they have finite dimensional matrix representations, but the x and the p don't. So right away, we are dealing with infinite dimensions. Let me quickly show you how that comes about. Imagine for a moment that the position and the momentum functions were representable as matrix-valued functions where the dimension of the matrix is finite. Let's say x of t and p of t are n by n matrix-valued functions. Well, then let's take that equation here, that the commutator of x and p is ih bar, and let's take ih bar times the identity, of course. So this would be the assumption now is that this is an n by n matrix valued function, that's an n by n matrix valued function, and that's just the n by n identity matrix. Let's see if that works out. Let's take the trace of that equation. Let's take the trace of the left-hand side and the trace of the right-hand side. Well, the trace of a commutator, no further questions asked, the trace of a commutator of two matrices is always vanishing because the trace of one matrix plus the trace of another matrix is the trace of the sum of the two matrices, and the trace of AB is the trace of BA. So the trace of XP is the trace of PX. The trace of a commutator of two matrices is always vanishing. So the left-hand side is vanishing, but what do we have on the right-hand side? On the right-hand side, we have the trace of IH bar times the identity matrix. This is IH bar times N. Right? The trace of the identity matrix is n, the dimension of the space. So what we get is that 0 on the left-hand side is equal to ih bar times n, the dimension of the space. So clearly, x and p cannot be finite dimensional matrices. Because if they were, then we could do this thing with a trace and we would get the contradiction. If we make the number of dimensions larger, it doesn't get better. It gets worse. We get that 0 is equal to ih bar times a larger and larger number. However, it turns out that the x and the p are allowed to be matrices as long as those matrices are infinite dimensional, such that the trace is not well defined. This is how it works. So what we see is that quantum mechanics right away requires us to work with infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. So that's the math of it. The x and the p can be represented as operators on vector spaces, but those vector spaces will have to be infinite dimensional. And they will have to be Hilbert spaces and so on. I assume that you've seen all of that. So that's the math of it. The physics of it, of course, meant that there was the uncertainty principle. And the uncertainty principle implies that there are quantum fluctuations. You can't predict both x and p with certainty. This was a big step. Previously, physicists had learned to work with uncertainty. But uncertainty was always an expression of ignorance. In classical physics, there are often situations where we do not know what the outcome of an experiment will be. We can only give probabilities for the outcome. But in classical physics, the reason why we cannot predict precisely is always that we simply are ignorant about some parameters of the theory. In quantum mechanics, it appears that uncertainty has a deeper origin, where there are no parameters that we could know such that the uncertainty could be reduced. Quantum fluctuations, random behavior, seems to be a fundamental feature of nature and not simply express our ignorance of things. There can really be things that happen without a reason. They just do happen. Quantum fluctuations just happen without having a reason. Okay, so far so good. That was all the 1920s. Soon it turned out that non-relativistic quantum mechanics, the thing that we just discussed, became untenable too. Just not satisfactory. It was not precise enough. Let me just quickly summarize non-relativistic quantum mechanics for you again. It consists of two things, the canonical commutation relations and the equations of motion. The equations of motion, all of them, can be written in this way. Imagine you have an expression in the x and the p's. F is some function of the x and the p's. In order to keep things clean, you may want this to be a polynomial in the x and the p's, perhaps a power series in the x and the p's. Then the time derivative of that function of the x and the p's is given by the commutator of that function with the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian generates, in this sense, the evolution of all the variables, the x, the p's, and anything you can build from the x and the p's. So that's non-relativistic quantum mechanics, and it became unsatisfactory. It became inconsistent with experiments. Now, why is that? Well, it's because non-relativistic quantum mechanics is not consistent with special relativity. Consider, for example, the electron in the ground state of a hydrogen atom. The typical momentum, the expectation value of the momentum of such of the modulus of the momentum of an electron in the lowest shell, that momentum corresponds to about 1% of the speed of light. Experiments in atomic physics can be done with way more precision than 1%. Nowadays, those experiments can be done with precisions that easily measure like 10, 12 digits. And even in the 1930s, it was already possible to measure the spectral lines of atoms like hydrogen with a precision better than 1%. And clearly, the speed with the electron having, roughly speaking, a speed of 1% of the speed of light, we should expect that there are corrections to non-relativistic quantum mechanics of at least the order of a percent. So non-relativistic quantum mechanics couldn't describe these things. So how to improve on quantum mechanics? A generalization of the Schrödinger equation had to be found. And there were two main candidates. There was the Dirac equation, and there was the Klein-Gordon equation. Both had successes, but both also had serious problems. In both cases, it turned out that the energy was not bounded from below. But when you have a theory in which the energy is not bounded from below, then it describes a universe that's not stable. Because what could happen is that, for example, an electron and a positron, or an electron and a proton, could get closer and closer and release in the process more and more energy. It would be nice. You could solve all energy problems on Earth in this way with just one proton and electron, but it's not going to happen. So it's an unstable theory. Also, it wasn't clear what happened to the unitarity of time evolution, and therefore to the conservation of probabilities. Also, what the Klein-Gordon equation and the Dirac equation were not able to accomplish is to account for a strange, newly discovered experimental fact, which was that particles can be created and particles can be annihilated. How can that be described? In non-relativistic quantum mechanics, you cannot describe the creation or destruction of a particle. It's just not part of the framework. And the Klein-Gordon equation and the Dirac equation can't do it either. You have a certain number of particles, and that's the number you're stuck with. How do you describe particle creation and annihilation? So a new idea was needed. And already in the 1930s, Heisenberg and others came up with that new idea. And that's the idea that they called second quantization. It was quite an ingenious idea. It started with this observation. In quantum mechanics, and by that they meant Schrödinger equation or its relativistic generalization, the Dirac equation or the Klein-Gordon equation. So in quantum mechanics, everything is subject to quantum fluctuations, like positions fluctuate, momenta fluctuate, energies fluctuate, and so on. Everything is subject to uncertainty, therefore, except for one thing. In quantum mechanics, one thing is not fluctuating. And that's the wave function itself. Right? So you have positions fluctuating, momenta fluctuating, energies fluctuating. But the wave function, no, it's evolving completely deterministically. Just like in acoustics or in classical electromagnetism, according to quantum mechanics, the wave function behaves completely deterministically. If you know its initial conditions, then you take the equation of motion, like the Schrödinger equation, and then you can calculate what the wave function is at a later point in time. No uncertainty in this. It's completely deterministic. So Heisenberg and the other guys said, well, that's not very quantum mechanical. Everything should be fluctuating a little bit, including the wave function. So they said, well, let's try this. Let's try to quantize quantum theory. Let's try to have even the psi fluctuate. So their program was this. Consider regular quantum mechanics. In addition to the positions, we are also considering the momenta. The momenta are basically the position's time derivative. When I put a dot over it, it means time derivative. Okay, so let's just choose for the mass units such that the mass is equal to 1 to keep things a little simpler. So what they said is, in quantum mechanics, in addition to the position variables, we have the momentum variables, which are obtained by taking the time derivative. And then once we have the momentum and along with the position, then we can do quantum mechanics. We can write down non-commutativity between them. So ordinary quantum mechanics works this way. You have your degrees of freedom, like the position. You look at the canonically conjugate momentum to it. And then you assume two things. One is the equations of motion stay the same, and the other is non-commutativity between the degrees of freedom and their canonically conjugate momentum. The commutator between x and p is ih bar. So they said, okay, in second quantization, let's try the same thing for the wave function. So the degree of freedom that they were concerned about is psi itself, psi, the wave function. And then they said, let's introduce to psi also a canonically conjugate momentum by taking the time derivative. So in addition to psi, they also looked at psi dot and called it pi. Okay, so just like x by taking the time derivative gives us p, here we take the wave function psi, take the time derivative, and that gives us pi. In quantum mechanics, we may have three positions, like x, y, z coordinates. And that gives us three momenta. In second quantization, there were many more degrees of freedom. Namely, there was a psi for every position. So basically, here we have a label I that labels this position, that position, that position. Here we have a label x. So there's a psi for every x. And there's a psi dot for every x. And so we have a pi hat of x. So you should really view the x here as being like the I label on this x there. Okay, sorry that this x is playing a different role than that x, but this is how it goes, second quantization. Okay, so we have here, for one particle, because we want in ordinary quantum mechanics, we would have 3 degrees of freedom, x1, x2, x3, and 3 canonically conjugate momenta. For the wave function, we have psi of x for all x in R3. So we have infinitely many, uncountably infinitely many degrees of freedom. And each one has a time derivative, and we get its canonically conjugate momenta. In quantum mechanics, using this, we impose the canonical commutation relations. We say that the x degree of freedom commutes with the p degree of freedom if they are of different labels. If they are of the same label, we get IH bar. For quantum fields, the idea was, okay, so the psi should commute with the pi if they are of different labels. If the x, which is, remember, plays the role of the label here, if the x is different from the x prime over there, then this is just zero. So they wrote down a Dirac delta now, which is zero if x is not equal to x prime. If, on the other hand, x is equal to x prime, then this thing should peak. It's the Dirac delta because this has continuous labels, whereas this has discrete labels, so we get a Kronecker delta. So you see how this goes. Second quantization's idea is that we want the same equations of motion for psi as ordinarily, but on top of that, we require that it has non-trivial commutation relations with its time derivative, with its canonically conjugate momentum. This was a pretty wild idea, but it worked for a while. It turns out that with this ansatz, you can solve the earlier problems that the Dirac equation and the Klein-Gordon equation had. Namely, the energy could be arranged to be always positive. So you describe a universe that is stable rather than unstable. Also, unitarity can be preserved. But this has mathematical and physical consequences. By the way, I can make this full screen here. It's better. So let's look at the mathematical consequences first. Well, if psi hat and pi hat don't commute, well, then they can no longer be number valued. Remember that wave functions used to be complex number valued. But they can no longer be complex number valued because they don't commute. So this psi hat cannot be number valued. It's got to be something like matrix valued or operator valued. In fact, with the same argument as earlier, taking the trace and so on, we can easily deduce that this psi hat cannot be finite dimensional matrix valued. It works with infinite dimensional matrices, with, in general, with operators on infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces, but it won't work for finite dimensional ones. So it turns out that those guys will have to be operators on an infinite dimensional Hilbert space. And what about the equations of motion? Well, remember, should still be the same. And the first second quantization that was done was really the second quantization of the Schrödinger equation. No attempt was made to make it consistent with relativity. They just took the Schrödinger equation and then said, the wave function psi, we now make non-commutative with its canonically conjugate momentum. And the equation of motion, Schrödinger equation, we keep. That worked very well. And so they were encouraged then to do the same thing for the Dirac equation and the Klein-Gordon equation. So what's the physics of it? Well, it turns out that now you have an uncertainty principle between the wave functions and their canonically conjugate momenta, independent of the details of this. I mean, you see, it's a bit messy because this is a Dirac delta here, not a Kronecker delta. What it clearly means is that whatever happened to the wave function, whatever happened to the psi, well, it's got to be subject to quantum fluctuations now, which is, of course, what we set out to do. Second quantization's purpose was to make sure that everything is quantum fluctuating, not just the positions and the momenta, but even the wave function. Nothing should be deterministic. So, indeed, the psi itself will fluctuate. There's going to be an uncertainty in the psi. And that had interesting consequences for the physics. Let's consider particles. The uncertainty principle, now for the fields, for the wave functions, that uncertainty principle allowed one now to describe particle creation and particle annihilation. See, the wave function itself is uncertain. The norm of it is uncertain. In quantum mechanics, the norm of a wave function is 1 because it's one particle. The sum of the probabilities of finding it anywhere is 1. You find one particle with certainty. But if the thing is fluctuating, sometimes you may find fewer or more particles. So this framework of second quantization allows one to describe particle creation and annihilation. Also, it allowed one to describe antiparticles. In fact, it required one to describe antiparticles. And this is what resolved the issue of the negative energies. We will get later to the reason exactly why there were negative energies coming up. In any case, the negative energy particles in this framework of second quantization could be taken care of by the assumption that they travel backwards in time. In that case, they appear to us, who are traveling forward in time, as particles that do travel forward in time, but have opposite quantum numbers. Because if you change the time evolution, attraction becomes repulsion. So all the quantum numbers are opposite. And that worked out very well. So this was regarding the particle picture. Now let's look at the wave picture. Here's something dramatic came out. Namely, it turned out that if second quantization works, then even in the lowest energy state, in the absence of any particles, even in the vacuum, therefore, there must be fluctuations. See, when the wave function's expectation value is 0, the uncertainty in the wave function is still finite, which means that even if the expectation value is 0, so the expectation value in the vacuum state of what used to be the wave function is vanishing, the expectation value of the wave function is 0, it doesn't mean that for certain, you don't find anything when you check. And indeed, this is typically what you see when you check the vacuum. A field, a quantum field, typically looks like that in the vacuum state. You can calculate what the probabilities are for finding this or that configuration. And this is a field configuration, a configuration for the psi, drawn from the probability distribution that second quantization gives us. These things can be measured now. Quantum fluctuations of the vacuum can be measured directly now. So in a later lecture, I'll play you a little bit of a recording of it. A friend of mine at the University of Queensland measured quantum fluctuation with a so-called quantum homodyne detector, and we have a bit of a recording of that. Anyway, part of the goal of this course is to show you how to calculate that sort of thing, how to calculate fluctuations of a quantum field, and plot them, for example, in this way. And the project of this course will also have to do with calculating quantum fluctuations. quantum fluctuations are now known to be at the heart of chemistry. For example, the van der Waals force and the Casimir force trace back to quantum fluctuations. Yeah, and as I said, quantum fluctuations of the electromagnetic field can now be measured directly and are being used, for example, to generate random numbers. You know that random numbers are a valuable commodity now, because for cryptography, you can use them. They can be very useful for cryptography in order to produce so-called one-time pads, which are unbreakable. Even with quantum computers, that's not breakable. Now, in principle, you could, of course, generate random numbers by taking a piece of radioactive material and then measure the decay of it, and the time between two clicks of a Geiger counter gives also a random distribution that's truly random because it has a purely quantum origin. But it's pretty slow. You can't produce gigabytes per second in this way. Well, you can, but you don't want to be anywhere near your experimental setup. But you can nowadays measure also the quantum fluctuations of the electromagnetic field, which is completely harmless. That's what the quantum homodyne detector does. And there you can produce gigabytes a second, just measuring quantum fluctuations. And we will get to that in more detail later on. Oh, and quantum fluctuations, as we discussed earlier, just of that kind, are thought nowadays, that's part of the standard model of cosmology, are thought to have seeded the condensation of galaxies, of hydrogen into galaxies, and therefore structure formation. Okay, so the aim of this course is to introduce second quantization, so-called quantum field theory. I gave you here the historical perspective, the way that it actually was developed. But remember, too, that I should point out that the modern view is no longer that second quantization is the second quantization of the first quantization of the Schrödinger equation. But instead, the idea is that fields are primary, and we just quantize the fields. Still, you can play with the idea, you wouldn't be the first one to do so, of what happens if you did third quantization, fourth quantization, and nth quantization. It's beautiful to think about it, but it quickly gets out of hand, becomes totally abstract. Nobody knows how to make actual predictions from that. But the standard view nowadays is that fields are primary, and we just quantize the fields. It's a bit like questioning quantization itself. What does that mean? We take a classical theory and we quantize it. It's a totally historical view of things. It has nothing to do with nature. Nature is quantum mechanical. And then you can try to recover classical theory from it in a certain limit. But to think that we start with a classical theory and then somehow make it quantum is something human. Nature doesn't operate this way. Nature simply is quantum mechanical everywhere all the time. And so similarly, the modern view is not that we have to quantize anything, but the modern view is that quantum fields are primary. We don't have to derive them from anything. Okay, so we will study quantum field theory, which is the modern term for what used to be called second quantization. And we will study quantum field fluctuations in the presence of curvature of space-time, expansion of space-time, horizons, stuff like black holes, but also horizons that emerge when space-time is expanding very rapidly, and gravity. And ultimately, we want to see how field fluctuations of that kind, of this kind here that we just discussed, could have created the original inhomogeneities in the universe. So as I mentioned earlier, the inflationary scenario goes back to the 1980s. If I only knew how to switch this thing off. Yes, but then I have to go into a menu. There ought to be just a button for that. Okay. Right, so it goes back to the 1980s. And here is a picture that I stole from somewhere in the internet. Sorry about that. So structure formation. If you look at the literature on structure formation, it talks about various steps. There is a distribution of stars and galaxies, like this would be a galaxy, distribution of galaxies in the universe. Earlier, there were clouds of hydrogen in which stars started to ignite. And earlier, there were more diffuse clouds of hydrogen with just a few stars. And even earlier than that, there were just hydrogen clouds, which were a little bit inhomogeneous. This is actually totally exaggerated. Originally, the hydrogen clouds had density fluctuations only of the order of like 10 to the minus 6. You wouldn't see that if you plotted it this way. This is so much, the contrast is a lot enhanced. And that would have its origin in quantum fluctuations of the order of 10 to the minus 6, energy density fluctuations of the order 10 to the minus 6. In this course, we will not be concerned with the later steps. We will only be concerned with the quantum origin of the original quantum fluctuations. Now you may wonder, well, but why was the universe so flat to start with? Why was it so homogeneous? Why do we have to imprint inhomogeneities onto it? Could it not just start out wrinkly? But the beauty of the standard model of cosmology is that it accounts for the experimental fact that the universe seems to be extremely flat on large scales. As soon as you average over scales of a billion light years or so, there is basically no evidence for any non-flatness. It's completely flat, completely homogeneous. I mean, very, very homogeneous. And nevertheless, there were small density fluctuations imprinted on that, with a particular kind of statistics such that if you go through all of those calculations, and that's just basically classical physics of overdensities and underdensities getting stronger and stronger because of just gravity, and then eventually arriving at that. So the experimental evidence is that the universe seems to be extremely flat on large scales, but has a particular pattern of inhomogeneities on it. And the standard model of cosmology says this is because the universe started out with a tremendous expansion, which was such that if the universe was initially a little bit wrinkly, then after that enormous expansion, all the wrinkles were ironed out, and it was completely flat. Except for quantum fluctuations that, with the expansion, were also stretched out. And those quantum fluctuations imprinted a little bit of inhomogeneity. So this picture of a universe that started out with an enormous exponential expansion, almost exponential expansion, describes pretty accurately why the universe overall is pretty flat, but has a particular pattern of small perturbations imprinted on it at this stage, which of course eventually become large perturbations, very nonlinear perturbations. But in the early regime, you could still describe these things as linear. So our target is just this: calculate the original quantum fluctuations there. And along the way, we will also do the Unruh effect, Hawking effect, and things like that. OK, so that's an outline of where we are going in this course. Do you have any questions so far?
Would the size of the fluctuations be determined by the radius of the horizon as it was expanding? So the size of fluctuation would also change as the universe expanded?
Yes, a very good question. In fact, that one of the key things that we will have to calculate. It turns out that quantum fluctuations happen all the time at all scales. The electromagnetic field in this room is fluctuating. It's mostly large amplitudes with very small quantum fluctuations around them. That's why we don't actually see quantum fluctuations happening. But it's always fluctuating, and even on the scale of a meter, of wavelengths of a meter, the electromagnetic field will have fluctuations of this enormous size. Just the amplitude is likely to be extremely small. And we will be able to calculate eventually with what probability a quantum fluctuation of a particular wavelength will happen with a particular amplitude. The larger the wavelength, the larger the amplitude, the more unlikely does the quantum fluctuation become. On the other hand, at very small wavelengths, quantum fluctuations are very likely, even with large amplitude. The smaller the wavelength, the larger the amplitude. The larger the probability that they will come up with a large amplitude. Now, when the universe expanded almost exponentially, then it was able to drag with it and expand to large size all those wavelengths that were a little larger than the horizon during the expansion. So a key length scale is the horizon during the expansion. And by the horizon, I mean the phenomenon that when the universe is expanding very rapidly, then two observers that have a certain distance from each other will no longer be able to communicate with each other. Because if observer A is sending a light signal to observer B, then the light signal needs, well, it can only travel at the speed of light. But it can happen that the universe is expanding so rapidly that the rate at which space is being created between A and B exceeds the rate at which light can cross space. So therefore, A may send a signal to B, but it will never arrive because it wants to get closer to B, but the distance increases faster than the light can travel that distance. So one says then that A and B are more than a horizon apart from each other. So that's a horizon in the sense of not being able to communicate. It turns out that for waves, a horizon has also a particular meaning. Remember, so for observers, there is a certain distance, depending on the rate of expansion. If two observers are further away than that distance, the horizon length, then they can no longer communicate. Let's ask what happens to waves whose wavelength is larger than the horizon length. It turns out, as we will see, that those waves stop oscillating. Waves whose wavelength is larger than the horizon length during an expansion, those waves simply no longer oscillate. They're sort of frozen. It's a simple phenomenon even in classical wave theory. They become, stationary waves are like standing waves, right? But those waves are not even standing waves. They're just frozen. They just stay in whatever amplitude they have. And it turns out that this is not just classically the case, but also quantum mechanically. So quantum fluctuations will simply freeze, all the while being expanded along with the universe. That's how quantum fluctuations, which happen at very small scales, very small wavelengths, and therefore large amplitude, can become quantum fluctuations of large wavelengths and large amplitude. Simply because they are stunned, they are completely frozen by this phenomenon of the very fast expansion. So the horizon size is critical. in determining which quantum fluctuations get stretched to cosmological size and which will not. Only those quantum fluctuations that are larger in wavelength than the horizon size will get expanded so far. And just to give you an idea of the order of magnitude, the standard model of cosmology holds that the size of the horizon during the early period of inflation was about 10 to the minus 28 meters. So any two observers that are further away from each other than 10 to the minus 28 meters could no longer communicate, because light cannot travel 10 to the minus 28 meters fast enough. This is how fast the universe expanded then. It's an outrageous theory, but it matches the experiment.
So the inhomogeneity that we see today, it will largely wait to the initial epoch, very initial time.
Yes, initially there was very small inhomogeneities, but then they were enlarged simply by the instability of gravity. When there was a region with less density, another region with higher density, well, the high density region attracted more hydrogen, and the low density region lost hydrogen, right? And so it all built up the inhomogeneity. But still, not all of the hydrogen clouds have condensed. There's still clouds contracting and forming stars and so on. Also, we will get to why the universe was filled with hydrogen in the first place. I mean, when did it become filled with hydrogen? And where did the energy come from to create all that hydrogen gas? We'll get to that. It's part of the beauty of the theory of cosmic inflation, that it provides an origin for the matter in the universe as well. It describes why the universe became so flat. Well, because it was stretched out. And then it was pretty much empty, because even if there were things in the universe earlier, after this enormous expansion, everything was so diluted that you might as well say it's empty. But then the energy that drove this enormous expansion, that energy had to go somewhere eventually when the expansion came to an end. And that energy was then used automatically to produce particles. So it filled the universe with particles. And then the universe was very hot at the very beginning, because it was filled with all those particles, in which this energy from the expansion was. And then the universe cooled down through several phase transitions, and eventually left behind the hydrogen gas, imprinted on which were these inhomogeneities arising from quantum fluctuations, and then from there, the structure formation started.
Should each space-like separable region start having its own fluctuation, you should end up with a fractal pattern, because each region, all the time, there will be new regions with their own local fluctuations?
Yes and no. There are fluctuations here, they are independent from fluctuations there. However, one of the distinguishing features between the theory of cosmic inflation and other theories of structure formation is that the theory of cosmic inflation predicts that there are actually large-scale coherences, that there are inhomogeneities in the universe that have large-scale correlations. If you, for example, consider the idea that the inhomogeneities in the universe arose from phase transitions that went too fast, just like water cooling into ice too fast, then you don't get as many large-scale correlations. If you take water and cool it down so that it becomes ice very quickly, then you get milky-looking ice. And the defects in the ice, the mismatch of the crystals in one end of the crystal, are pretty much uncorrelated with the mismatch on the other end of the crystal. So you don't get large-scale correlations there. Not as much, anyway, as with the quantum fluctuations. because the quantum fluctuations are calculated by doing a Fourier transform of the quantum field, and then every wavelength has its own harmonic oscillator, which has its own quantum fluctuation. So in particular, there are harmonic oscillators for wavelengths that are very, very large. And that harmonic oscillator has quantum fluctuations and imprints its fluctuation over very large scales. So that's the origin of the fact that the statistics of the inhomogeneities is different for the different theories. Cosmic inflation predicts a different statistics from the theory of defects, for example. In fact, many cosmologists think, just because the equations suggest it, it's not that experiments drive us to think that, but the equations suggest, and it's compatible with experiment, to think that the universe itself, our universe itself, mushroomed out of a previous universe due to a quantum fluctuation. We will get to that. All right?
Just one more question.
Okay.
Is there a physical interpretation to the momentum wave function like you have for the psi here now? A new interpretation. As conjugate to psi.
Well, yes, but it depends on the theory at hand. In the case of the electron, I don't know of any simple interpretation for the canonically conjugate momentum field. But in the case of electromagnetism, for example, it's easy. Roughly speaking, if you declare the electric field to be the degrees of freedom, then the magnetic field is the canonically conjugate to it. In fact, the Hamiltonian is basically E squared plus B squared, just like in ordinary quantum mechanics, the Hamiltonian of a harmonic oscillator is x squared plus p squared. But you can't, at least I can't, give you a general answer to that. It depends on which field you're dealing with. We still have time.
So then the second quantization and the first quantization, so when x and b are in the same direction, the commutation is finite.
Yeah.
But for phi and psi, the commutation, when we go to the same point in the space time, diverge. So are there like some interpretations for that?
It's the origin of the fact that quantum field theory is mathematically a nightmare. Seriously. Roughly speaking, what it means is that the uncertainty principle gets totally out of hand because there. What is this supposed to mean? Right? It's not a finite value. It's either zero or it's ill-defined. For x equal x prime, and this is not infinity, this is just not well defined. We will have to do better than this, and we will do better than that by smearing this. We take psi and we smear it over a little region, and we take the pi and smear it over the same region, and then we can calculate something like an uncertainty principle there. Right? So instead of taking the commutator between psi at x and pi at x prime, which gives us this uncertainty principle that doesn't really make concrete sense. What we can do is we can take psi of x and integrate it over a little area. And this gives us then a sort of average psi over an area. And then we also take pi and calculate its average over that area, or not really area, but volume. Okay. So we average psi over some finite volume. We average pi over some finite volume. Then we get this average operator, and it's canonically conjugate momentum. Their commutator has something finite over there, because the integrals will make the Dirac delta peak somewhere, and no, so it all works out nicely. You get some finite answer. And then we can study what happens when we make that volume smaller and smaller. As the volume gets smaller, we get back to that case here, where we have psi at a point and pi at a point. But let's say we smear it over a volume and make that volume smaller and smaller. What we find is that the uncertainty principle is such that as we make that volume smaller and smaller, we get larger and larger quantum fluctuations. So basically, what happens is this. Consider a fixed state of the quantum field theory. And now we take the average of the psi, let's say in the vacuum state, the average over a volume. Then the average value in the vacuum is zero. But we can calculate what is the delta psi, what's the variance, what's the standard deviation. And it turns out that the smaller the volume is, the larger are the fluctuations. So we should visualize this as quantum fields fluctuating like mad at points. They just fluctuate completely out of bounds. If, however, you average a quantum field over a little bit of volume, then the fluctuations at one point will offset fluctuations at another point. You basically have lots of extremely fluctuating things, but the average of those things is not fluctuating as much. So if you take a large volume, you get a lot of averaging out, and you get some reasonably sized fluctuations. In fact, if you take a volume as big as this, the fluctuations are on average basically zero. We don't see fluctuations of the electromagnetic field at such large scales. We can measure them, but only with huge effort. If, on the other hand, we average only over a very, very small volume, then less averaging out happens, and the fluctuations are still large. If you go to very, very small volumes, the fluctuations get completely out of hand, very, very large. This is the origin for the so-called ultraviolet divergences in quantum field theory. This is why infinite renormalization is needed. And this is also why the quantum field theory of the interactions of particles is mathematically not on a solid footing. We always have to assume that we smear things over. Always have to assume that we never look at distances smaller than a finite smallest distance, because otherwise we get infinities. Fortunately, in this course, we won't have to deal much with that, because we are not really calculating the scattering of particles of each other. There, infinities arise all the time, and they have to be regularized and renormalized with great effort. In our course, we are studying the quantum fluctuations in their own right, not just what they do when particles interact with each other, but just on their own right. And then we will still have some infinities occurring, but it's not as bad as it is when you calculate the scattering of particles. The origin of all those infinities is really the fact that you don't have a Kronecker delta, but you have a Dirac delta there. And it turns out that it depends also on the number of dimensions. If you take a two-dimensional quantum field theory, then the averaging works much more efficiently than if you take a three-dimensional one or four-dimensional or five-dimensional. It turns out that in 3+1 dimensions, it's critical. In 3+1 dimensions, we can just about handle the infinities. In 2+1 dimensions, it would be fine. In 1+1 dimension, easy. In 4+1 dimensions, impossible. So somehow we seem to be at the critical number of dimensions. Yep?
So the interpretation of psi was different in Q1 from UFT. Then in curved space, it will again change. Isn't it something, some sort of unsatisfactory in some manner? That the fundamental theory keeps changing its goalposts.
between flat space and curved space, psi keeps its meaning. It's just that from first to second quantization, it changes. And as I said, the modern view is not that we should think of this as arising in second quantization. We should view this as being primary. Basically, all quantum field theorists agree that the psi are the primary things, the fields. But then opinions diverge a little bit. The traditional view has been that the fields are just mathematical tools, and what can be observed is only particles. So we always have to use the psis as tools, mathematical tools, to calculate probabilities for particles to behave in such and such way when you smash them into each other. You will find textbooks that say that this is what it is. Fields are just mathematical tools, and the only thing that is real is particles. Those textbooks are old, though, old-fashioned, though, because it turned out that the fields are actually themselves pretty real. We don't have many experimental handles on the psis themselves. It's not easy to measure the amplitudes themselves, but the universe has done it for us in cosmology. It turns out that the psi sometimes imprint their fluctuations on space-time, namely, especially at the beginning of the universe, shortly after the Big Bang. And in order to calculate how the quantum fluctuations of the field imprinted themselves into space-time, you don't need to, and in fact, you can't use a particle picture. It wasn't particles that did it. It's really the field's properties of a quantum field that imprinted those fluctuations in space-time. Basically, the fluctuations in psi meant fluctuations in the energy momentum, and fluctuations in energy momentum imprinted themselves in fluctuations of curvature, and those fluctuations of curvature meant fluctuations in the temperature of the hydrogen gas, meant fluctuations in the density of the hydrogen gas, and that translated into structure formation later on. But it wasn't really the particle picture. So therefore, today we can say that the quantum fields really have the full range of interpretations that quantum fields had in 1925, before quantum field theory. Namely, they describe particle phenomena as well as wave phenomena. There are true wave phenomena, quantum wave phenomena, not just quantum particle phenomena. More questions? So one of the first things we'll do is see how to calculate. Where is it? To calculate these sorts of things. And that will also be part of the project. So I'm thinking of handling this course in a way similar to the course last term. So there wouldn't be a midterm or a final, but instead an essay and a project. The project will be to calculate quantum fluctuations of that kind. I'll go in a lot of detail how that's done. And for the essay, I'm not sure yet, some topic that you can write about, I don't know, 7-8 pages about. Those who came late, could you perhaps just briefly say who you are, how far you are in your studies? You missed it when we went around earlier, before we started. Maybe let's go around, yeah? Okay.
Second year master's, planning to finish before the end of this term, ideally.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I got first year master's. I haven't taken the course. I
I can do that. Sure. Okay. Okay. Who is your supervisor? Okay. And who are your supervisors?
My supervisor is Professor Mina.
Okay. Ah, yes. Oh, I see. So you are Ida?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Who came later? You came later, yes?
I'm Tom. I'm in the last term of the double undergrad. I work at IPC. Just kind of thing.
Second last term of undergrad. My name is Steven.
Okay. Great. Well, if there are no further questions, I see you on Thursday.
Office hours?
Not regular, just tell me and we'll find a time.